Welcome to Discovering and Sharing Shuswap History.
Young men lived on the farms of their parents, working for room and board. It was long hours and often 6 days a week. If anyone was paid for the work, it was as little as $10 a month. And it wasn't all bad, though. Everyone was in the same lot, and a community of young men who work, ate, and played together formed. In the winter of 1932-33, Harry Metcalf came back home to Silver Creek around the same time of young Scottish immigrant Johnny Cummings, who was being sponsored by Harry's father, Jack Metcalf. Johnny was supposed to stay 1 year per sponsorship of immigration laws at the time, but he ended up staying five, working on the Metcalf farm, and him and Harry became friends. They were united over a love of baseball, but had trouble finding local areas to play in. The nearest organized field was 12 miles away in Salmon Arm, an arduous journey back then. Frequent trips were downright impossible, not to mention, most people only had Sundays off and weren't always eager to host baseball games on their days of rest. Still wanting to play, however, Harry and Johnny came up with a plan to get the team going in Silver Creek. For about 3 or 4 months a year back then, any male 21 years or older could work what was called relief work, improving roads and buildings, fixing up roads, brush removal, etc. For this work, the men received $30 a month, a hefty sum at the time. Typically, this work came in the fall to help the farm workers through the winter months. Harry Metcalf did some math and figured if each man worked an extra day's labor of road work and donated that money, they could afford equipment needed to play the game. Harry approached a local road foreman, Harry Swanick, and he agreed to give them the shifts. Swanick was British and knew nothing of the game, but he loved the boys' enthusiasm. A meeting was held in March 1933. Every man present agreed to donate the wages. White and green were unanimously decided as the team colors, as was the name, the Silver Creek Comets. The checks were handed over to Harry at the end of the fall, and an order was sent to the T. Eaton Company for a complete set of baseball equipment. 7 gloves, a first baseman's mitt, and a complete umpire uniform, mask, body pad, and mitt, not to mention 2 bats and 2 balls. When all was said and done, $2.64 remained in the coffers. Harry's mom stitched shooting stars in the boys' uniforms, and an S on the left breast, and a C on the right. There were other struggles for the team, not at least of which was the lack of an actual playing field. A location was scouted out between the community hall and school, but it was covered with scrub trees, brush, and stumps. The land was donated by one George Ennis, but a lot of work needed to be done. There were no bulldozers, chainsaws, or any other mechanical equipment that could help, but there was the community. Farmers brought horses, harrows, and discs. Men with saws and axes cleared the brush and trees. Stumps were pulled as women and children piled and burned debris. A heavy log was dragged by 2 teams to level the field. Then discs and harrows did their work, as did hand rakes and shovels. Foul lines were laid out, and base and home plates were laid. Now, Harry and Johnny just had to show people how to actually play the game. Practice was set up, and a few rules were laid out. Balls were too expensive to throw away, so if one started to tear, it'd be immediately handed off to George Payne, who would stitch it back up. Every time one of the players was on the diamond, they were supposed to pick up 5 rocks and take them off. This included practices and in-between innings in official games. This helped beautify the still rough field. Eventually, the team became a formidable force and were one of the first teams invited into the Salmon River Baseball League. The league was created by then-incumbent R.W. Broome and Art Collins and included a Monty Lake, Westwold, Falkland, Grandview Flats, and of course, Silver Creek team. The lineup of the Silver Creek Comets morphed throughout the years and little records exist of the team, but credit where credit is due, these were some of the men on the team. Clarence, Jim, Bill, and Kenny Haynes, Frank and Roddy Timpany, Herman Connor, Bill Down, John Cummings, Alfred Nadoba, Harry Metcalf, Len, Ivan, and Ray Scott, Wal Donnelly, Art McGregor, Harry Newman, John Sims, Leonard Sears, and Hal Fowler. Fowler was known as the team comedian and had the hardest throw. He'd be set up if the opposing team started to look a little bit too comfortable. He wasn't the most accurate, throwing more balls than strikes, but he threw so hard, most hitters swung anyway, too terrified to be possibly slugged by a fastball. They were often glad to sit down. The team swept the league 3 years in a row and were given permanent possession of the R.W. Bruin Trophy. The team traveled in an open truck supplied by the Haynes boys' father, Jay, and driven by Bill. Later, when it was more difficult for Bill to pitch and chauffeur, Neil Campbell offered transportation, and that was how the team toured the league. The team's final season was sponsored by Clinton R. Beer, Haberdasher. He got uniforms with his name on them for the team. Harry Metcalf passed away in 1994. Thank you to Frank and Harry Metcalf's writing in the book Silver Creek Ramblings. Both of their writings were instrumental in helping write this piece. Again, from the book Silver Creek Ramblings, story entitled Bill Allardyce, as remembered by Myrtle McLean. Bill Allardyce was a well-known resident in the early days. I don't recall what year he came, but I suppose it was around 1915. Bill was the son of a wealthy Englishman, and he had at least three brothers and one sister. The family had lived in Valparaiso, Chile, where Bill was born, but had moved back to England before he came to Canada. According to Bill, he was about 9 months old when a fire occurred at his house. In the excitement, furniture and belongings were thrown from an upper story, and somehow the youngster was thrown out as well. He was discovered amidst the furniture and had suffered a head injury that left him somewhat mentally challenged. As a grown-up, he was sent to Canada as a remittance man. Meaning he was expected to look after himself with the aid of a regular allowance from the family estate. Bill's father, and later his brothers, kept in touch down through the years, and Bill made several trips back to England. But apparently, he preferred Canada. He took up a homestead and hired men to do the clearing and build a house. The house burned down and was replaced by one containing an iron framework sent from England. It also burned to the ground, leaving the frame badly twisted and crumpled, so a third house was built out of local material. You see, Bill never cut firewood. He just put logs in the stove and kept pushing them as they were consumed. Bill tried to make a farm with the labor of his neighbors, and as he did not lack for money, there were always men who were glad to get extra income. Bill did end up with a working farm and made regular shipments to Salmon Arm Creamery. Bill once had an argument with another Bill, Bill Merrill. It was something about a wandering cow and ownership thereof. When the matter reached court, the judge asked Bill if the animal was branded. Well, Bill said no. Then the judge asked, "How can you prove she's your cow?" Bill retorted, "Mr. Judge, do you have a wife?" The answer came back yes. Then Bill asked, "Is she branded?" His Honor replied no. Bill's last words were, "Then if another man walked away with her, how could you prove she belongs to you? I know my cows." In the spring of 1921, my parents, Roland and Emma Rourke, took on management of the Allardyce farm. By this time, Bill's father and his favorite brother, George, had died. It had been agreed that the Rourkes would make a home for Bill as long as he lived, and upon his death would assume ownership of the land. Roland and Emma Rourke had a homestead at Maple Lake. Roland cooked for logging crews around the lake in the winter and augmented summer income by hiring out to other farmers near Enderby. When the Enderby mill closed in 1914, it also meant the end of logging operations at Maple Lake. My parents then resorted to renting farms as the opportunity arose. One day, my mother, sister, and I were visiting friends in Armstrong, and Bill Allardyce happened to be present. Soon after this meeting, Bill decided he wanted us to move to his farm. Although I was only 10, I can remember not being very favorably impressed with the deal, especially after seeing Bill's house. I'm sure he never swept his floor and certainly didn't bother to ever clear food remains from the beautiful, solid oak dining table. It looked like his meals consisted largely of bread, jam, and tea. He enjoyed a cup of tea any time of day. While living temporarily in a cabin by the river, Bill decided to visit England, leaving a considerable amount of money in a trunk. One day, A.P. McLean was looking for some cattle that had wandered away, and he found the animals had entered the dwelling and created an awful mess. Mr. McLean also discovered paper money trampled in the dirt. He felt he could not leave the cash lying around, so he took what he could find home and spent some time cleaning and drying it. When Bill returned, Alex McLean handed over the money, but Bill claimed there had been a larger sum stored in the trunk and told Father some had been stolen. Bill once had a sudden impulse to visit his family. Not even bothering to bathe or change from his working clothes, he went straight to the train station and set off. I don't know how he fared on the train, but when he bought a first-class boat ticket and entered the lounge where the rich passengers were expecting a pleasant crossing, he caused quite a stir. When he arrived at the Allardyce home, the unshaven and unkempt Bill didn't look familiar to the butler, who ordered him around to the kitchen entrance. Fortunately, Bill's sister was entertained in the parlor and recognized her brother after going to the door to see what the commotion was about. The sister told the butler to take Bill and clean him up and give him some clean clothes. Bill meekly submitted. He'd had his joke and was ready to be civilized again. Relations between my father and Bill soured, partly due perhaps to talk among some of the neighbors who resented strangers coming along and depriving them of favors from Bill's generosity. Bill also did not have the capacity to see through their schemes. One of the bones of contention was a pickup truck Father had persuaded Bill to buy, thinking it would be useful on the farm. Father never learned to drive, but my brother had. A slight accident occurred, and the truck had to be taken to the dealer for repairs. It was still in the garage when we left around December 1st. My parents were in real difficulty finding a place to move to. We finally located an unfinished shack above Yankee Flats. One morning, before daylight, following a heavy snowfall, Bill turned up in an exhausted state to apologize to my brother for the way he had reacted over the truck incident. But it was too late to set back the clock. Another family moved into Bill's place as we were moving out. I never knew what happened, but they didn't stay too long either. I have told this story, not to complain about our neighbors, but to show Bill Allardyce's integrity. W.B., Bill Allardyce, died at Halcyon Hot Springs, B.C. in December 1934, thus ending a 35-year residence in the Valley. He was survived by one brother in Silver Creek and other relatives in England. And now for a different sort of history than we normally cover on this program, I wanted to look at the geological history of the Shuswap region from the book Everything Shuswap by Jim Cooperman. Scientists have estimated, using radiometric age dating of meteorite material, that some 4.5 billion years ago, the planet Earth formed from a cloud of dust orbiting the sun. It took millions of years to cool and form the crust that later separated into the continents that exist today. During the cooling time, the Earth was bombarded with asteroids that brought the many diverse compounds and elements that make up the Earth. The initial crust, which is thought to be basaltic in compound that formed as the Earth cooled, was replaced with the younger basaltic crust that forms the ocean basins and granitic crust that forms the continents. The continental crust appeared some 4 billion years ago, and the pieces left from these first continents are called cratons. Some of the oldest rocks on Earth are found in North American Craton of Canada. As the planet cooled, clouds formed, and the resulting rains created the oceans. Some water may have also come from colliding comets. Heat from the interior of the Earth and the force of gravity provided the energy that moved the oceanic and continental crustal plates. Accompanied by enormous earthquakes and volcanic eruptions, the process known as plate tectonics began about 3 billion years ago and created different land masses that formed supercontinents. These split apart, accumulated more sedimentary and volcanic rocks, then collided and split apart again, and this process continues today. At about the same rate as the growth of your fingernails, the North American continent moves west, enlarging the Atlantic Ocean. Although there is evidence of microscopic life from as far back as 3.7 billion years ago, it was not until approximately 2 billion years ago that photosynthetic life in the form of single-cell organisms appeared and produced the oxygen that created the atmosphere we have now. By the beginning of the Cambrian period, 580 million years ago, multicellular life had developed hard parts capable of being preserved as fossils. Over many millions of years, the sea life also contributed to the formation of limestone rock layers as their shells accumulated through the process of sedimentation. Underlying our region is a section of a Precambrian craton called the Shuswap Terran, which is over 2 billion years old. Most of the rocks found in the Shuswap are metamorphic, including primary schists, argillite, gneiss, and phyllite, formed from either igneous or sedimentary rock by heat and pressure. Plate tectonic processes created the mountains we see today. In addition to the mountains, these plate movements and earthquakes created folds and fault lines, and many of these became distinct geological features. To the west and east of the Shuswap Terran are parts of the Kootenay Terran that show up in a narrow strip between the Rocky Mountains and the interior plateau from the Kootenays all the way north to the Yukon. This terrain is part of the ancient continental margin of ancestral North America. The rocks, now highly folded, faulted, and recrystallized by plate tectonic processes, range in age from about 1 billion to 150 million years old. Plate tectonics lift up part of the Earth's crust and depress other parts. Uplift forms plateaus, but erosion carves these into mountains and valleys. Near the Shuswap region, collision of crustal plates formed the Rocky Mountains. At the close of the mountain building period, some 60 million years ago, compressive forces died away, and the crust experienced existential forces as crustal plates moved in different directions. This led to the formation of faults in what are now the Southern Rocky Mountain Trench, the Columbia River at Revelstoke, and the Okanagan Valley. The valleys were formed by erosion of the crushed rocks in these fault zones. The Columbia River Fault slopes down to the east, while the Okanagan Valley Fault slopes down to the west. These faults separate upper and lower levels of the crust. Between 50 and 45 million years ago, as upper levels slid down to the east and west, the lower levels rose at least 20 kilometers, bringing the old metamorphic rocks of the Shuswap Terran to the surface. At the same time, molten volcanic rocks moved up through the crust, heated water in the crust, and lubricated the fault zones. These rocks also formed numerous volcanoes at the surface. Lava flows have erupted from fissures in the earth along a belt extending from the Yukon to as far south as Yellowstone. Some of the flows flanked the Monashee Mountains, which prevented the lava from flowing east of Maple Lake. While most of the lava has been removed from erosion, a few hills remain covered, such as Mount Ida, where volcanic rock overlays much older igneous rock. Another example can be found in Denison Bonu Park, situated south of Lumbee, where there are ancient hoodoos hidden in the forest. Many of these are also present in the Okanagan Valley. There is no evidence of recent volcanic activity within the Shuswap watershed, but to the south of the watershed near Kelowna, there were volcanic flows as recent as 700,000 years ago, which in geographical terms is quite close to our time. The final geological forces that created our unique geography were the periods of glaciation that first began about 2 million years ago, particularly the last ice age that began melting approximately 13,000 years ago. There are various theories about the cause of the advancing and melting of glaciers, including massive volcanic activity, a shift in the Earth's orbit, or changes in the sun's activity. Prior to the melting, a vast sheet of ice and snow nearly 2 kilometers in depth covered this entire region. As the ice melted and receded, it blocked drainage to the west, and water accumulated, reaching 155 meters above where Shuswap Lake lies today. As a result, siltation resulted in a layer of fertile soil along the North Broadview and Glen Eden benches. Water flowed south out of this lake through an ancient spillway to the Columbia River and created the chain of small lakes and bogs along what is now Highway 97B. When the ice dam to the west gave way, the lake drainage was redirected to the Fraser River towards the Pacific. To the east of Sycamous at Canby, there was a constriction of the drainage by a lingering ice lobe that created a temporary lake at the site of Malaqua. Rotting vegetation was deposited there, along with ancient dead trees that had grown during interglacial period, which created the thick level of peat found there now. Most of our rivers and creeks follow ancient fault lines, and that is why creeks that enter rivers from different directions sometimes match each other, indicating smaller fault lines that cross perpendicular to the larger river faults. Glacial meltwater was channeled into these faults, carving off the softer material, guarding the canyons found today. The ice sheet melted, and the glacial waters filled many Shuswap valleys and deposited the loose till material, including the soils, sands, gravels, rocks, and boulders that cover the valley bottoms and hillsides. However, the Shuswap's large, deep, narrow lakes are remnants of ancient faults and were still filled with giant fingers of ice, which prevented the glacial melt from filling them with sediment. At the outlet of nearly every creek and river is a fan of sediment laid down over thousands of years, and this process continues every time there is a major erosion event after bouts of heavy rains atop melting snow. The fan created by the Eagle River covered a portion of Shuswap Lake, forming the Sycamous Channel and Mara Lake, and the Adams River fan formed the Little River and Little Shuswap Lake. The Shuswap region is defined by its watershed, which includes the rivers and streams that all eventually empty into Shuswap Lake and the South Thompson River. However, it is the Monashee Mountains that actually direct much of this flow of water. These mountains, in turn, form part of the Columbia Mountain Range that includes the Selkirks, Purcells, and Caribou Mountains. Within the boundaries of the watershed is the distinct Shuswap Range that includes Queest Mountain and lower peaks and ridges. There is also the Hunter's Range that extends north and south of Mara Mountain. The tallest peak within the Shuswap region is Mount English at 2,701 meters, and the second tallest is Mount Fosthall at 2,679 meters in Monashee Provincial Park. At one time, these mountains were called the Gold Range. An early prospector, David McIntyre, renamed them Monashee, which is commonly considered to be Gaelic for Mountain of Peace. However, local historian and writer Don Elser has a new theory, since mountain in Gaelic is actually sleeve and peace is seath. Elser believes that Monashee more accurately describes the mythical fairy inhabitants of the island of Mona, and this theory corresponds to a movement in the late 1800s to restore old Gaelic culture. The Monashee Mountains extend some 320 kilometers from Bailemont in a narrow band all the way into Washington State and are made up of some of the oldest rock in British Columbia. Unlike the Rocky Mountains, which are primarily made of sedimentary rock, the Monashees are mostly metamorphic rock, with some bands of granite or igneous rock. While most mountaintops are difficult to access, except for the most experienced climbers, many Monashee peaks are relatively easy to access by hiking or even driving, especially those peaks within the Shuswap watershed. Perhaps one of the most appreciated features of the Monashee Mountains is its ability to trap the moisture from the Pacific and thus create consistently high snowpacks that not only supply our lakes and streams with ample water, but also provide some of the best skiing conditions in the province. Whether one enjoys sledding, Nordic skiing, alpine skiing, or backcountry touring, there are plenty of opportunities to find great snow in the Monashees from late fall to spring. In addition to the high snowpack, all of the moisture trapped by the Monashee Mountains helps to create a type of forest ecosystem that is unique to British Columbia, the inland rainforest. Massive cedar, hemlock, and spruce trees, some older than 1,000 years, can be found in these forests along with species of ferns, lichens, and shrubs adapted for the cool, very wet climate found in the Shuswap. Fortunately, some of these forest stands have been protected as parks, although most of these giant, ancient trees were turned into lumber due to relentless logging for over 100 years. One section of the Shuswap Range, the Anstey Range, is currently a no-staking mineral reserve due to its extremely unique status. These mountains contain syenite, a rare coarse-grained, intrusive igneous rock, similar to granite, but without the quartz. As well, there is carbonatite, another rare igneous rock that can also include rare earth metals. Consequently, this portion of the Monashee Mountains has been set aside for research purposes. Most of the igneous minerals, including those that are so important for advanced societies, were at one time molten liquids that were formed into veins or deposited in layers mixed with other compounds. The most sought after, gold, often eroded and became deposited into creek beds and ended in gold pans or is removed with placer mining. Scattered throughout the Shuswap, as in many other regions, are vein of quartz, a commonly found igneous mineral. Mostly missing throughout the Shuswap are igneous-formed granite-type rock formations that climbers prefer, but there are exceptions, and many of these areas have become destinations for the local climbing community. An early accessible example can be found adjacent to the Siphon Creek waterfall in Glen Eden, where there are granodiotrite cliff that have bolted roots. Other areas include Cult Hill, Haynes Creek near Silver Creek, and a massive rock face on the east side of Adams Lake. It is also rare to find sedimentary rock like limestone, shale, and sandstone in the Shuswap, but once again, there are a few exceptions. The gypsum located above Falkland is a lightweight sulfate mineral associated with sedimentary rocks and deposited from lake or seawater or from ancient volcanic hot springs. Once again, that is from the book Everything Shuswap by Jim Cooperman. Thank you.
My name is Dorothy Rolin. I'm the current president of the Salmon Arm branch of the Okanagan Historical Society. If you have stories or memories you'd like to share with this program, please call Voice of the Shuswap at 250-463-5026 or email info@voiceoftheshuswap.ca. Discovering and sharing Shuswap history.
This radio program was made possible by a Government of Canada New Horizons grant, helping celebrate Canada's 150th anniversary.